Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 11th, 2011. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, how bitter can a beer get? I asked Dr. Brad Sturgeon to see how many IBUs he could cram into a beer. And I asked our panel of tasters in San Diego to see if they could pick out the bitterest beer. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. Also, you can find our brewer's logbooks to help you log and track your batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Well, thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support. I know it doesn't cost you any extra, but it sure takes that extra step to remember to go to our site first, and we greatly appreciate everybody who's been doing that. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores, and we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory now, too. We've got a lot to cover today, but I did want to get a couple of quick emails in. Paul from Massachusetts and then California wrote in, "I just got around to listening to your podcast about gluten-free brewing, and I'm happy to see that my question about using potatoes got onto the show. But I chuckled a little when you said my name was Joseph." Oh, no! Oh, no, indeed. In no way is that a big deal or upsetting. I just wanted to point it out and nitpick. Well, thanks a lot, Paul. Sorry about that. Paul goes on to say, "I'm actually re-listening to your podcast about kvass." That's the beer made with bread, by the way. "As I found a renewed interest in the beverage after moving to a part of Los Angeles that has a high Armenian population, I'm deviating a bit and using my homemade sourdough as the bread and my personal East Coast sourdough culture as the yeast. But it's always great to review the experiences of others. We'll see what happens." Well, let us know how your kvass turns out, Joseph. Paul. Sorry about that. It must have been a translation problem from Twitter to my brain or something at that time. Micah from Sunnyvale, California writes after hearing the yeast rehydration experiment show. Micah says, "I have a hypothesis that might explain some of the rehydration results. Good old-fashioned natural selection." Micah says, "When pitching dry yeast directly into the wort, the data seemed to indicate that some percentage of the population doesn't survive. I can't speak from personal experience, but getting completely dehydrated, then rehydrated, has got to be stressful. So if, say, half of the population doesn't survive, which half is it? The weaker, damaged, more sickly half. What doesn't kill the population makes it stronger. With an overall healthier population, the dry-pitched yeast can quickly grow its numbers without competition from resource-consuming laggards. This would explain why, in many cases, the dry-pitched yeast started bubbling sooner and had better attenuation. What do you think?" Well, that's another good question to discuss over a pint or two of well-crafted homebrew, I think. Is sprinkling without rehydrating, weeding out the weak, leaving the strong to survive and ferment the beer? Or is it just the least damaged that move on to ferment the beer? Either way, it's food for thought and a possible, and it is a hypothesis, and it needs to be proven with some experimentation. Food for thought, though. Either way, I appreciate that, Micah. I hadn't thought about it that way. Let's move on to our experiment for this week, and it's the last one, sadly, from San Diego, California. You know, we were out there for the National Homebrewers Conference, and when I heard that Dr. Brad Sturgeon was headed out that way with his wife, Kath, I took advantage of the situation. I took advantage of his talents in the lab, and I challenged Brad to use the lab at Monmouth College to see how many IBUs he could cram into a bottle of beer. And I asked Andy Sparks and Steve Wilkes, along with Danny and Matt from last week's show, to help us taste the results. Now, I know this could be a controversial show once you hear the results. I don't want to have a spoiler here. So I want to challenge you to write down any questions or comments or responses that you have about this experiment and send them to me, because I plan on doing a follow-up discussion with Brad next Tuesday morning. That's when we're going to record it. So we can answer your questions at that time. So kick back and listen, and then email me your questions and responses, as usual, to james@basicbrewing.com, or just use the contact form on basicbrewing.com. All right. Well, we are here on the patio again. We're going to taste more beers, and this is a bitter thing that we're doing. This is featuring someone that, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, you've heard on a handful of episodes, long distance through Skype, but this is the first opportunity this week that we've got to meet in person. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Brad Sturgeon.
Hey, all right. It's great to be here, guys. It's wonderful to see you guys all in person.
I'll add the studio applause later on. Joining us as regulars are Andy Sparks.
It's really great to be here. This is a super exciting experiment. Yeah.
Who's a very bitter man. And Steve Wilkes.
And I'm a very bittersweet man, because this is our last tasting of the conference.
And from a previous episode, other than the dinner tonight, from a previous episode, Danny and Matt from Canada, welcome, guys.
Great to be back from Vancouver. We just lost the Stanley Cup. We're bitter already, but looking forward to the beer.
So I challenged Brad. I heard that Brad was coming. I was like, let's have some fun. And do you remember the challenge that I set to you?
Well, I think you asked me how bitter can a beer get, and I guess so. We just decided to do some 1 gallon boils, some 1 gallon beers, and you said keep adding the hops. So we added and we added and we added, and we got 4 beers here to taste.
So Andy, you may be one of the best qualified to answer this, but on the labels of beers and on, you know, some of the websites and such, some beers claim to be hundreds of IBUs in strength, right?
Yeah, well, that's correct. Yeah, and if you do recipes, if you're ever trying to clone a beer, you'll find that some beers, some clone recipes, if you punch it in the computer, it's going to come out and say it's 250 IBUs. I know the Pliny clone regularly calculates out in that range, but it doesn't seem to be 2 times as bitter as a 100 IBU beer. A 100 IBU beer sometimes doesn't even taste terribly bitter based on its balance and everything. So this is why I said I was really excited about this, is because this has been interesting to me for a long time, is what's really going on there, and is what we think really true about the bitterness and how much we can finally perceive in the finished beer.
And I guess, should we back up and kind of give a basis on what makes a beer bitter? I mean, obviously hops is what you add and usually into a beer to make beer bitter, but what is it about hops and the process of boiling hops that makes a beer bitter?
Well, from the chemistry standpoint, I look at a hop as having all these resins and oils and other complex things, as we learned today from Bamford's talk, that he said that there's like 200 different essential oils, and of course we know about the alpha acids and the beta acids, and so I think the challenge that we have in a beer is to try to get those compounds to be soluble in a beer. And actually, I think that's one of the things that the homebrewing world hasn't necessarily addressed totally, is about the solubility of things. We know if we take sugar and put it in our sweet tea, you can put a lot of sugar in there. And if you're in the South, you know that a good sweet tea has some solid sugar on the bottom, right? But, you know, if you could have a teaspoon where you start putting in alpha acids or isomerized alpha acids, you know, you're going to put in a very small, you know, teaspoon of it, and it's going to show solids on the bottom. The solubility of isoalpha acids is, you know, not very great. So, I mean, so the definition of an IBU, as actually I looked in Randy Mosier's book today, Radical Brewing, he made it very specific. He said the IBU measurement is spectrophotometrically measured, you know, absorbance at this particular wavelength of light, and that corresponds to the number of milligrams of an isomerized alpha acid that will go into 1 liter of beer. All right, so a 100 IBU beer, it says that there's 100 milligrams of isomerized alpha acid in 1 liter. So, so you know, the thing about solubility, though, is, you know, just like our sweet tea analogy, you just can't, you know, there's a certain limit that you reach when you add in sugar. It, you just can't push it in there any further. Now, solubility is dependent on temperature, but we generally drink the beer at a, you know, at room or colder temperature, right? And so even the process of cooling a beer might actually lower the solubility of some things that might have been in that beer, and they sit on the bottom. You know, I personally like to take the last swirl of a beer, get a little extra vitamin B in there from the yeast that might have fallen out, but there's probably some bitter components in there as well.
And we also heard a talk earlier, and I'm going to cheat and look at the program to make sure I know who gave the talk. But Hop Boil Chemistry, Colin Kaminsky, gave an awesome presentation on hop boil chemistry and the things that are going in there in the bitterness. And some of the things that he said was, and he named a number for the ceiling of IBUs in a volume of beer, but he said he was sending his beers off to white labs and getting them tested, and he was not reaching that number, and he had to ask himself why, what was going on. And so he said some things that isomerized alpha acids actually stick to the cells of yeast and get flocculated out, mm-hmm. and they actually stick to the surfaces in the kettle. And if you are a brewer, home brewer, who uses an immersion chiller, there's lots of surface on that immersion chiller, and so if you're looking for a certain level of IBUs in your beers, you are probably going to have to pump up the amount of hops that you're putting in at the beginning of the boil. So there are a lot of variables in the equation, and it'll be interesting to see what your numbers came out as in the end of that. So how did you design the experiment?
So in our nutrition lab at Monmouth College, we have I call it a four-tier brewing system, meaning hot liquor tank, mash louder tun, kettle, and then fermenter. And the reason I separated into four instead of the traditional three is just because each one of those tiers has a certain number of chemistry principles that tie into it. And so if my biochem faculty member wants to learn about enzyme activity, whether they work on second tier or the fourth tier, fermentation or mash louder tun. My organic chemist wants to think about isomerization, you know, you work in the kettle, and we kind of build those things. So, you know, so I'm trying to get brewing more at the forefront of general chemistry, and in a chemistry curriculum, I think it's kind of neat to bring that. The students seem to like discussions of beer. So, but anyway, so yeah, so we got our 1 gallon brewing system, the four tier. We did a couple trial recipes. I think, James, as you told me, that with smaller batches, you get lots of boil-off volume. So I think the first beer I made ended up to be about a 1.090, a 1090 beer. So we thought that was maybe a little bit too rich. So I went up and I started, and actually we can post those details of the recipe, but we're talking about a 1.5 gallons of reverse osmosis water that we get out of our chemistry lab. Our nutrition lab has a feed for reverse osmosis water in there. We added 3 grams of gypsum at about 35 degrees Celsius. I stirred it at that point to make sure that went into solution, and generally it did. We added about at 75 degrees Celsius, we added 1.2 pounds of light DME. And
that's dry malt extract.
Dry malt extract, that's right. And all the time we were monitoring the temperature in the kettle to make sure that I knew that we were very specific about a 60-minute boil. So all of my notes are very clear that the graph that I've provided to you guys here at this table shows that sometimes those boils were a little bit longer, but in some cases that was because I forgot to add the hops other sorts of management issues, but the beers were all, or the hops were all added at a 60-minute addition. There were no other additions of hops except for at the 60 minutes. Now, again, there were four beers that were brewed. The first one had 1 ounce of, or excuse me, 0.1 ounces of hops. Then I went to 0.3 ounces of hops, 0.5, and 0.7 for the four different beers.
And what hop did you use?
We used a 10.3% alpha acid Centennial.
So pretty straightforward. I mean, and then how did you ferment, and what yeast did you use?
Let's see. For the yeast, I've been getting into yeast, and actually at this meeting is just outstanding listening to Chris White and Jamil Zainashev about yeast. And so I've started doing canning of my wort, and so I can very easily sort of take a little bit of yeast from a bucket and wash it and save it. So I had some 1056 yeast that I had saved and had restarted. I made five different mini starters on the day before. We ended up only using four of those. So pretty standard, not a real high pitch rate. And again, I'm not sure exactly how the beers are going to come out as far as that. I probably bottled them a little bit early. They are probably not fully carbonated. But, you know, there was only such a time window since we had this discussion about doing this. But, you know, as far as measuring IBUs, you're talking about the solubility of those isomerized alpha acids. So if you do it right after the kettle, there's nothing as part of the bottling or the fermentation process that should affect that. Now, maybe a little bit of the fermentation, you got some settling out. As we learned, some of those alpha acids will stick to things. And But you know, our thoughts are here that if you keep adding in more and more hops, are you going to get higher and higher IBUs? As Andy mentioned about the calculations, if you just plug them into a calculator, it just keeps going.
Yeah.
So we need to know what that ceiling is, I think.
So essentially, you're if I understand you correctly, you're measuring the IBU level in the wort and not the finished beer. Where did you make that calculation?
I had about a 10-day fermentation time. So at the time of bottling, okay, which was on June 13th, so 5 days ago, I bottled. And at the same time I bottled, I took samples to do the IBU analysis. Okay. The American Society of Brewing Chemists, the ASBC Beer 23A. Is the method that you use for determining IBUs.
Okay. So what we're going to do here is you have those four beers, and we are going to do a blind tasting of those four beers. You're going to determine a random order that you're going to, we're going to put these in our glasses, and we, I guess, are going to pick out which ones we think are more bitter than the others. Is that essentially what our task is?
Yep. I can't remember what the calculated IBU was, but I'll talk about that later. But again, we're talking about the first beer having 0.1 ounces, second one 0.3, 0.5 ounces, and 0.7 ounces per 1 gallon. So in each case, you know, you're going up by about 0.2 ounces. So I think that top 0.7 ounces to 1 gallon worked out to be an IBU, sort of a theoretical calculation of about 150 IBU.
According to a calculator.
According to a calculator, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And you're going to randomize those so that we... Okay.
Yep.
So, gentlemen, start your palates. We've got some pita chips here that we're going to clear our palates. And so we were, again, going to... Anything else that we should know before we get into this phase?
I think we just got to turn on those taste buds, and then I'll tell you what my instrumentation told us.
Awesome. Yep. This is cool. Exciting.
Yeah.
Okay. Any questions from you guys from the Circus Peanut Gallery as we before we get into it? Okay. Well, we will we'll pause, and then we'll come back. Well, first of all, I think you know, despite the fact that these are experimental beers with just extract and some bittering hops, they're pretty tasty.
I've had better, but I don't think there's too many flaws in it. although I think a single edition at 60 minutes, I think we could justify mid and late edition hops as a yeah. good part of a pale ale. So
yeah, it's not so much very interesting on the hop character, but I think. First of all, let's not talk about which one we think is which, but just general characterization of the tasting experiment. What do you guys what impressions did you take without saying which one you think is the bitterness, you know, without ranking, what were your impressions?
I was very surprised that it wasn't more easy for me to pick out the most bitter. I think it was easy for me to pick out the one that I thought was the least bitter, but the top three, they seem to be very close together. And it was part of the problem, too, is that because they are very bitter, you're trying not to drink a whole lot at one swig because you know you're going to have to try to balance that against that next one. And you want to be able to discern the difference. And if you blast your mouth with a huge bitter blast of hops, it becomes difficult.
We did have some pita chips, thanks to your wife, Kath, Brad. Thanks, Kath. Say hi.
Hi.
but we did clear our, we're able to clear our palate between each one, so that was helpful. So general impression, Steve.
I was surprised actually at how good the beer tasted. They all tasted pretty good. I agree with Brad that a couple of hop additions would make it more. But to be more to the point, I thought it was interesting that I felt like I could choose the one, just like Andy, that was least bitter much more easily than I could choose the one that was most bitter. But as I went through my little tasting protocol that I did, I was surprised that it didn't change. So I tasted them two or three times, and I came away with the same order each time. So we'll see what that means. I don't know.
And Danny, you randomized your randomization. They were already random. The samples were already random, and then he randomized the random samples just to see. Why did you do that?
Right, it was partly through my sample. I just wanted to. I don't know why, but it can't hurt. Is the only thing. And then I looked at Andy the whole time, and that was wonderfully entertaining. Overall, I'm surprised how good that was. I've made way worse beers and put a lot of time and effort into designing the recipe and DME and a bunch of centennial. It's not half bad. That blew me away. I can't believe how good they were. I was like, oh, these are going to be really, really bland. Maybe the mildest malt character, but, you know, attenuation was good, and they're all clean. They're all nice, well-made beers, but just not complex, but I've made so many bad beers. This is really frustrating to see that can make that good of a beer. But
the range of the flavors or the range of the bitterness, did you think, could you easily discern between them? Not thinking which one is which, but could you easily discern?
Well, my randomization that we got previously and then my double randomization that I did and then looked at Andy. Bottom, I could pick out, I think, pretty confidently. And top were a little tricky, but you kind of bounce between the two. You kind of work your way. It's only four samples. You work your way through it, and you pick these are the top two, and you kind of go back and forth and clean your palate all you want, but you really want to, if you taste one and then taste the other and it's more bitter, that's the kind of one you shoot for. So I don't know. I hope my answers are right, but it's tricky. Those top end are remarkably close considering the jump in the amount of hops in it. You go from 0.1 is low, 0.3 to 0.5 to 0.7. You'd think 0.3 to 0.7 would be a huge difference in it, and it's not. Yeah. From what I tasted,
I was also surprised how close they all were. I guess maybe it's the lingering sensation of bitterness that is why it's hard to discern between the four, because you have one, you can try and clean your palate, but there's still lingering bitterness maybe from one to the other, so maybe that's why it was so difficult. But I was surprised at how similar they all were in bitterness levels, perceived bitterness anyway.
Yeah, I'm probably going to be way wrong on picking the low and the high, because it was darn, I don't know if it's because we, you know, have been spending time sipping some, you know, the Belgian beer. But the Belgian beers were not bitter. We're not that bitter. So we shouldn't, our bitter receptors shouldn't be worn out by now. And there was some time between the tastings. So I don't know. I don't have much of an excuse, yeah. but it was really, really hard.
Let me just remind you. So again, the lowest hopped beer here is about a half an ounce for a 5 gallon batch, and then the highest amount is 3.5 ounces of this 10.3% alpha acid. So it should be a pretty large range of bitterness. And again, you know, so Danny, we should use perceived bitterness, right? Because you're always right, right? You guys are always right because it's your perceived bitterness. Yeah, and I think we all come to the table with different tools. You know, the chemistry lab, we only have one tool. So in some ways, the chemistry lab is a little bit more specific, but maybe it's not necessarily the way we should be identifying bitterness. I don't know. We can certainly come up with a number, and we'll share those numbers in a minute.
Okay, now we come down to the rubber meets the road. Who wants to go first as to okay, Andy, you want to go first? Which do you think was the, do you want to rank them, or how do you want to do it?
Okay, we have four beers. They were served to us in order 1 through 4, and the way I rank them is I put a number, you know, low to high. I found the number 3 beer to be the least bitter. I struggled between the first beer and the fourth beer to be the most bitter, and I finally resolved to the fourth beer being the most bitter. So that places the number 2 beer to be the one that's missing.
Okay. And you wrote that down. So, Steve, did you come out with something similar or the same? Or
Pretty similar. We differ a little bit. I actually picked the number 2 beer as the most bitter. I picked the number 4 beer as the second most bitter. Number 1 beer is the third most bitter. And I agreed with Andy that number 3 was the least bitter of the 4 beers.
I agreed the third beer was the bottom. Number 1 was the second. And I agreed with Andy as the 4 was the top. And number 2 got 3 for me.
I had the second beer as the most bitter, then 1, then 4, then also 3 as the least bitter.
Man, I'm... Okay, I'm going to be honest because, you know... I picked number 1 as being the least bitter, number 3 being the most bitter, and then it was kind of a tie between the other two. So either I'm completely wrong... Or I'm completely right. I mean, if I'm right, I'm really right, and you guys are really wrong because I'm going against everybody. So I'm either an idiot or, you know, the hero.
But you can't be an idiot in this analogy. It's what your taste perceives.
My tongue can be an idiot.
I can perceive you to be an idiot. That's
with that, but you knew that before we started the tasting.
But you're assigning intelligence to a perception, and that can't work.
Well, you're right. I mean, but either my palate is accurate on bitterness, or it's, at this point in time, it's dull as a hammer. So, I guess we'll. It's probably going to be painful for somebody. But that's just to say how hard this was. I mean, I could not. I expected to have a moderate gravity beer or a moderate bitterness beer as kind of a baseline and then be blown out of the water with the other three. That didn't happen, obviously, because I picked different from you guys. So,
well, you know, one thing is the whole point of this is to find that theoretical limit. And if it turns out that limit turned out to be in the second beer, well, that's why the other three taste very similar, right? You know, and they're about as bitter as the other ones, so...
I have a background in printing, so here's my printing analogy, which I've already given Andy. If you print a newspaper, you can only run a difference that we can see up to about 60-65% in the screening of the color black. So when you purchase an ad, for instance, and you build your ad in Photoshop and all that stuff, most newspapers will tell you that they won't accept anything or that it doesn't do you any good to request a 70% screen, because the human eye is going to perceive that, and the printing press can only print it, and it's going to be black. You're going to lose all the detail. And so if you want your photograph to come out well, you know, part of the art and the skill of that is understanding how that ink lays on the paper. I think that's a good analogy for what we're doing here, that there's a point where 70% is all we can perceive, so that might as well be all you put in there.
So you're wasting ink at beyond 60% or 70%. So if you're doing bitterness additions, at a certain point you're wasting hops because you're blowing the top of the palate out.
Yeah, but I wonder too, though, and this adds a variable that we didn't address here, but would that be different with different styles and different kind of grain bills, because you're going to have a different perceived bitterness with a different formula, a different recipe? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Well, but there is a different styles will have different bitterness levels, and different original gravities will have different bitterness levels, depending on the balance of bitterness to maltiness that you're going to have. But what we're talking about is the sealing of bitterness in a fluid. In other words, what we're talking about here is the perceived bitterness. I mean, once your tongue hits a certain bitterness level, and if it can't perceive bitterness beyond that point, then you're wasting bittering hops.
Right.
Does that make sense? So if you're adding 2 ounces of bittering hops at the beginning of the boil, when 1.5 ounces will do the same effect, then you're wasting 0.5 ounce of bittering hops. Now we're not even talking about aroma or flavoring hops, because that's a completely different thing. We're just talking about just bitterness at this point.
In the same way, did anyone taste 2 beers that tasted the same? They all tasted different. It was hard to discern which was more. So saying the extra 0.5 ounce is a waste, it's different. I can't. Yeah. You know, and we'll see when our numbers go up against the real numbers. None of them tasted like the same beer, and it almost would have been a fun thing for everyone to get 5 glasses and one of them to be doubled in each of our glasses. It could be a different one or one of them, but, you know, like, to have 2 of the same beer in there and see if you can...
To do a triangle test, which is 2 of the same, 1 different, and seeing if you can pick out the different one statistically.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, so... Now we've philosophized. We're doing is just dragging it out so we don't look like, you know, we don't know what we're doing.
Justification.
So that I don't look like I know what I'm doing. this is going to be painful. Brad?
Yeah. Well, I'll say that most of you have a proper perception of the bitterness.
I got to go now.
Actually, I'm quite surprised at the palates, most of them, because actually 3 of these beers, the top 3 hop additions, the largest amount, are very, very close in IBUs. And I think, as Steve was mentioning, our ability to tell the difference in IBUs, I've heard, is about 6 IBU units. You know, so we're not terribly sensitive at telling the differences between small ones. So again, it'd be a good idea, Danny, to have a sort of a side-by-side, and kind of like that's the mentality as you go into that, going, oh, that one's a little bit bitter, you know, more bitter than the other one, making that side-to-side comparison. Do you want to know the one? So, well.
I don't want to know anymore. I don't want to know anymore. Thank you.
Dinner.
Thanks for coming, Brad, and it's good to see you. And we'll see you next time, everybody.
Yeah, hey, you'll at least put applause in there, won't you?
Yeah.
Well, so the lowest IBU measurement, and again, using the American Society of Brewing Chemists, the ASBC method, beer 23A, where you extract the isoalpha acids from the beer, and then you run it on a UV-Vis spectrometer, so that's a spectrophotometric measurement.
You're just making it more painful for me.
It's not like you got...
So, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the number, the least hopped beer was 24 IBUs. And it was the third beer that I gave you.
Oh!
I guess 30.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. That's still a fairly hopped beer, though. That's not a low bitterness for a simple beer like this.
Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what I was saying with that.
Well, and so let's just go the other side of it. The
James is right.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, James, excellent. So the highest hopped beer came in at a IBU reading of 52, and it was number 4. It was the last beer.
Yes.
So 54.
Oh, mm-hmm.
So all those hops. So what? Okay. Well, no, we'll save that. Go.
Yeah. Well. So again, here I'll just start from again. We're adding 0.1 ounces, 0.3 ounces, 0.5 ounces, 0.7 ounces. So again, 0.7 ounces would be equivalent to 3.5 ounces of a 10% alpha acid into 5 gallons. It came out with a measurement of 52 IBUs.
Very nonlinear.
Yeah.
In terms of
The big one.
Sorry, the biggest one came out at 52 IBUs. Now, I'm not sure how we want to carry out this conversation, but if you do a calculation based on the two that I found, and again, I mean, there's a lot of different ways of doing these calculations, but the Rager, for that highest IBU, the adding 0.7 ounces to a gallon came out to be 150 IBU, or excuse me, 115. So 115 IBUs is if you converted all those the alpha acids into isoalpha acids. And I think that probably has an efficiency of probably 75% or something like that that would be typical for a hop utilization. So the numbers are, the measurements that I made are significantly lower. And again, since we're not doing this on TV, it's a little hard to maybe see these numbers. So maybe we can post some stuff. I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, if you want to make a PDF of your results, we can post that.
Share that, and want you to share that. And James, you and I can look at this. You see that there's a table that shows IBU measured and calculated with the two, the Tinseth, is that how you say that? Tinseth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the Rager methods of calculation are essentially linear. The more hops you add, the more IBUs you get. But it turns out that the measured IBUs in the beers that we made essentially, you know, level off around 50 IBUs. And so one of the perceptions you guys made in the discussion that was very accurate, I think, is that you said that three of them were very hard to tell apart. So, you know, you had the beers that were hopped with 0.3, 0.5, and 0.7 ounces were essentially 44 IBUs, 50, and 52. Wow. So the difference between 52 and 44 should be, you know, right at the perception level, and maybe side by side you could tell those apart. But we clearly hit a ceiling at somewhere around 50 IBUs. Now, you know, one of the things that people always ask you is that how do you know that what you're doing is right? One of the things that I did was after seeing that data, and I said, boy, 50 IBUs, I mean, you know, that seems pretty low. So I went out and I found four other beers that I then took in the lab and made the IBU measurement on. So I used the most hoppy beer was the Founders Rye IPA that I had on hand at home. Great beer. Reported at 70 IBUs. And when I went in the lab and measured the IBUs, again using the beer 23A method, I came up with 53. So that's about the top, maybe a tad bit above. But again, among friends, that's pretty much the top that we've hit there. Sierra Nevada comes in a reported value of 37 IBUs. And when I measured it, it was 32. My numbers seem to be lower in most cases than what the commercial beers are listing their IBUs as. Newcastle, I didn't think Newcastle had much bitterness to it, but it says it's reported at 24. My lab measurement said 15. Michelob Amber Bock, which I had in the lab because we were doing some color analysis, and that seems to be a standard for that, reported IBUs at 19, and I came in at 12. So my measurements are always seem to be a little bit different than what the reported values for the commercial beers are. But, you know, one of the things we've learned at this conference, though, is that a lot of times you can lose hops along the way. And I would guess, I mean, I worked a little bit in Frederick Brewing Company, which is now Flying Dog out in Maryland, in Frederick, Maryland. And when you make an IBU measurement, you make it fresh off the, you know, out of the fermenter, off the bright tank. And so, you know, that's about as fresh as you can get. You go ahead, you put it through a bottling line, you put it in a bottle. If it's true that surface areas and stickage and stuff like that, it doesn't seem unreasonable that Sierra Nevada might read an IBU when I measured in the bottle at 32, where they reported at 37 from the brewery. That could be an interesting addition to this experiment. I think we mentioned that I have some of these beers, and I can go back in the lab, and we may have an add to this discussion about I can do that analysis, and once I put these in the bottles, let them sit, let the yeast settle out, do all that stuff, maybe the IBU numbers are going to drop.
That's really interesting. So regardless of what the numbers say, and it would be interesting to see if you this just scratches the surface of, you know, what because it's just, as often happens when you do an experiment, it just raises more questions than you came in with, you know, because we had one question. Yeah, Danny said a chemist's wet dream. You got something to do. Get a grant. You know, regardless of, I mean, you've got some figuring to do maybe on the numbers to see what's going on there, and maybe, mm-hmm. you know, maybe we'll figure out what's going on. But the fact is that you seem to hit a ceiling in the process of around 50. More take or give or take what five mm-hmm. IBU points, and then the lowest was what 24.
Yeah, 24.
But it was darned hard to, for at least me, to to determine the difference in bitterness between even the lowest and the highest. So, but these guys were able to pick out the lowest, but. It seemed more difficult to pick out, you know, the highest in that range. So, to me, this is very educational. What do you guys take out of this? I mean, you start with you, Matt.
I was expecting to be a non-linear graph when you pass the graph over, but I was expecting to be so non-linear, I guess, was the shock there. How it plateaued from the, you know, whatever it was, 0.3 ounces to 0.7 ounces. Was not expecting it to be so close in measured IBUs.
Yeah, it's really impressive to me. Unfortunately, having a science background and being in the middle of a massive review paper I have to do for one of my supervisors in my degree, I'd like to see a replication, which would be, and that's the nice thing about doing 1 gallon batches, like, how much does that cost? It's not that much, but if you could do replication, like this is really amazing. And, you know, Tinseth and Rager, like, the amount of calculations they've done heavy measurements and stuff, I'm not gonna say that they did things wrong, but it's amazing to see on a graph and go look at the graph. It's really cool for anyone in a scientific background. That's a huge deviation from what is expected, and that's just fantastic. If you can put some replication behind that and get those same numbers, that's huge. That really changes a lot of things. And they were really close. That we all agreed that bottom one was really low and the top ones were a little hard. I happen to get the numbers right, which fist pump for me, but
gloat much?
Yeah, but that was.
And who won the hockey game the other day?
Come on, Boston. Yeah, okay. So we ride in Vancouver. We don't want to ride at the Homebrew Festival, but yeah, no, it was really cool, fantastic experiment. I love it. It's in every way I could love it, other than replication.
There you go.
Okay, so for me, I'm not a scientist, and I don't come at this I don't come at the flavor of my beers with a scientific background or approach. So what I take away from this is that thinking of it as a cook, thinking of it as what is this beer going to taste like, I agreed with Danny that all four beers tasted slightly different, but I'm more interested in how they tasted, and the fact that the three top beers tasted so much alike tells me that, I don't know how to say this, it's not as important to me. In other words, there's a place where it reaches a limit, and once I've reached that limit, I don't really care much. It becomes kind of a theoretical question to me that goes beyond my hobby. Now, if I'm a professional brewer, or I'm a guy that's really into the scientific side of this, that's a different thing, and I don't mean to dismiss that. But there's a place where it reaches a saturation point, and beyond that, I don't really care.
Yeah. Fabulous experiment. This is really an eye-opener. But, you know, you really can't argue with the fact that some people make beers that would calculate to insane numbers of hops, and they're hugely popular, and they are uniquely flavored. How do they do that? Is it other flavor compounds we call flavor hops that we add later flavor, but you still get flavor, as you were pointing out. So, what is it we're really getting out of that? You know, I mean, there's more to it than just the bitterness. But yeah, this was a real eye-opener.
Well, and you know, one of the beers that I've focused on over the last year was adding a little bit of rye to my IPAs, and it seems to bring up that bitterness character just really sharp. And, you know, it's very possible that there are some components of the rye that when you add them into the beer, they're not actually isoalpha acids that are dissolved, but there are other components that dissolve that sort of mimic an isoalpha acid in solution, not only in flavor, but also spectrophotometrically. And again, I think, you know, I have one more graph for you, and maybe any of the chemists who might be listening, we can post the UV Vis spectra. But I would say if we did this experiment with a different hop that had a different combination of the humulone, cohumulone, adhumulone, that actually you're going to get, as we learned about today, that there's differences in rates of isomerization. And so I think even if we did this with a magnum, let's say, that you're going to get a little bit different measurements. And so, you know, from my standpoint as a chemist and wanting to quantify this thing, you know, the Beer 23 method is just that. It says if you're going to list the IBUs, the International Bittering Units, it says you have done this analysis and the absorption at 275 nanometers was this. You multiply it by a conversion factor to give you then the IBU measurement. Now, if you're saying that your beer has 115 IBUs in there, you need to show me as a chemist your UV Vis spectrum that shows that your absorbance measurement is over 2. They will probably realize that the instrument maxes out at about 1.5, so you're going to have to start doing some dilutions at that point. And my experience a lot of times with the QA labs in a brewery is this is not the level of their expertise. Somebody in a brewery may say, hey, you put all those hops in there, it should be up to 95, and the guy in the QA or QC lab doesn't get the number. Well, it's in there, you know, taste it, right? It's so bitter. Like, I mean, the Founders Rye IPA is one of my favorites. It's just awesomely bitter, and it's a lot more bitter than any of these. But the IBU assay, Beer 23, says 53 and 52. It's a measure, you know. So I'm not sure. We maybe have to rethink about what the IBU assay means to somebody like Steve who's, you know, trying to, you know, perceive bitterness. So
I was really expecting at least one of these beers to be kind of like taking a hop shot thing. And just squirting it on your tongue, and I was surprised that none of them were.
Yeah, if you go back to what Brad was saying and about perceived bitterness in IBUs, and I think that's a huge... It's a preconception in brewing and home brewing and just the understanding of beer that IBUs means bitterness. It's not the only place we get bitterness, and I'm not an organic chemist, and I don't pretend to be an expert or anything, except to my friends. The hop oils and things like that, I'm not going to say that those don't make a hoppy beer seem more hoppy, seem more bitter and hoppy as a general term, but Pliny is bitterer than these. But I've made IPAs with way more hops than what you added in the top one, and it tasted bitter. But it's just amazing that it didn't come across that way, and then you have to start thinking, and we saw Bamford's talk and the other hop talk that we had, that there's a lot of things that go into how bitter it is. The IBU thing, I think, is only now, after taking part in this experiment, it seems a little overblown. It's a little bit over-exaggerated at how important it is, because I've seen bigger differences than this in way different, in way smaller differences in calculated IBUs.
Well, I think we're just kind of scratching the surface here, and it's an interesting first step and very surprising. And I want to thank everybody for tasting, and I certainly want to thank you, Brad, for doing the work. And this is just chapter one. We'll come back.
Sounds great. I look forward to it. And again, I think we need to think about solubility. I think that's something that's really important. And I don't mean to say that I know it all, but it doesn't surprise me that you reach a limit. You look at the organic structures of these molecules, and they're big, oily organic compounds. You're talking about parts per million. You know, I mean, this is a very, very small amount of stuff. This is not sugars dissolving in water. Mm. So, again, we're at sort of a certain level, and I think we've hit that max.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, James.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks again to Brad for all the hard work, and to Steve, Andy, Danny Seaton, and Matt Anderson, who came down all the way from Canada. You need to listen to last week's show to see what my excuse is for not for not being more on the ball. That was a tough one for me. I want a do-over. I want a do-over when I can test my palate again without having gone through a previous tasting of 17 other beers beforehand. That's my excuse. Although the other guys had the exact same excuse. Doesn't matter. At least you know I'm honest. You know, I could have edited that part out where I screwed up completely, but I kept it in there. So, as I said going into the interview, the results of this experiment may be controversial. You know, is 50-some-odd, is that the ceiling for IBUs in a volume of beer? That's not what we've heard, over the years. If you have questions about that or about the process or anything, especially after you look at the PDF that I'm going to post on in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com and on the Basic Brewing app as well. If after hearing the episode and looking at all that, you have questions or comments for Brad, please send them to me before Tuesday morning. And I'll give Brad a chance to answer them for a follow-up show. I think that'll be really interesting to do. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits as well. And believe it or not, we still have a handful of brewer's logbooks still in stock. You can find them all on our site. We got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks again to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Making Artisan Gelato, 45 recipes and techniques for crafting flavor-infused gelato and sorbet at home. And Vertical Gardening, grow up, not out, for more vegetables and flowers in much less space. Wish I could grow up and not out. I think that's... Maybe I need to grow a vegetable garden so that I can eat more healthier. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what on the Amazon link, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we do appreciate your support. You can also join the American Homebrewers Association and or subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through our associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.